Thanks for tuning in to Women's Voices in Context. My name is Genevieve Gluck, and in this episode, I speak with Hannah Borelli about the ongoing erasure of women's spaces, including online and in the public sphere. We discuss the impact of pornography on women and girls' decisions to claim a gender identity or to renounce the female sex. We discuss some violent male offenders that are being housed in the women's prison estate. And we also discuss Florida's Department of Health's recent decision to ban drugs that interfere with the natural development of puberty and gender identity-related surgeries for minors.
Hello, Genevieve.
Hey, Hannah. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. It's just getting to be rainy season where I live right now. So it's actually kind of nice if you're staying at home, not have to go anywhere. But if you do have to go somewhere, it's not great. But it is very lovely. How about you? Good. You went to Spain recently, didn't you?
I did go to Spain recently. It was beautiful. I'm obsessed. I want to learn Spanish. I want to go back as much as I can. I'm just completely obsessed. So if anyone has tips on the best ways to learn Spanish, my Twitter DMs are open and people should let me know, because there seems to be all kinds of different methods. But I also know that there's a huge women's movement in Latin America. So I think it would be really advantageous to learn as well, politically. But yeah, no, it was a great trip, and enjoyed the Easter weekend. Yeah, it's getting to be a bit warmer here, which I really appreciate, being able to be in the sun. So yeah, no, things are good. And I was sick for, had what I think was COVID, likely was COVID, and finally starting to feel a bit, I feel better now. So that was good, because that took me out for about 2 weeks. So yeah, I'm good.
Well, recently you published a piece for Redux.
I did.
Yeah, would you like to talk about that?
Sure, yeah. So I think those of us in the gender critical movement, or radical feminists, have known for a long time that Reddit is not friendly to feminists. You know, they've banned r/gendercritical. They've banned basically every kind of radical feminist and radical feminist adjacent community on the platform. And I think most of us know about the Amy Challoner affair, which was a man whose father was a convicted pedophile, and kind of did the rounds, jumped around to a bunch of different political parties in the UK because they all wanted a trans youth. And then eventually, after I think leaving that world just because he was very dysfunctional, ended up at Reddit in a very high up position. And then Reddit was banning any mention of him when it was exposed that he had connections to pedophiles. So we've known for a while that Reddit is not exactly a woman-friendly platform. We also know that it's a massive hub for pornography. And I kind of remember, I didn't mention this in the article, but I remember maybe 10, 15 years ago, that 20 years ago, Reddit was known as this like free speech absolutist platform. And when they say that, they always mean free speech for men, right? So we know that it's a hub for pornography. And it was always interesting to me. I would always every once in a while scroll r/lesbian actually, or r/actual lesbians, to see how quickly I'd run into a man pretending to be a woman and fetishized. And it usually was only two or three posts, right? That it would be a man saying something weird and pornified and making everyone uncomfortable, all the women there uncomfortable. So yeah, we did a bit of a deep dive into lesbian spaces on Reddit in general, and we found that there was a 46.76% overlap between men who are on r/male-to-female, which is like a transgender subreddit for men, and r/actual lesbians. And we found that anytime a woman would mention being exclusively same-sex attracted, she would be banned, and it was a very heavily censored space. But what was concerning for me, and what kind of led me to write the story, was that there was a subreddit called r/lesbian teen, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's supposed to be a space for lesbian teenagers, presumably. And again, it was a very transgender heavy, in that there were men celebrating being on exogenous estrogen, which they call hormone replacement therapy, which is not hormone replacement therapy, actually. Hormone replacement therapy is for women who are going through the menopause or other issues. So lots of celebration of male to female so-called transition, but also just like very stark safeguarding concerns. So there was posts from men looking for quote-unquote femme-presenting partners who, after reading their profile, we found that they were age regression fetishists. So there was lots of, and all obviously the usual shaming that women get for saying that they're not attracted to men. And yeah, so it's a real crystallization of what's been happening in the lesbian community in general since the advent of these kinds of politics. And when I talk to older lesbians that I know, or lesbians who were around during the second wave, or even later, like lesbians who, you know, were in lesbian spaces in the 90s and so on, it used to be that if a man showed up, like the women would kind of surround him and he would be removed. I have a friend who said that her trick was to go, hey, I just got to talk to you about something. I have a really important conversation. It's something that I have to tell you about. I have to tell you about it outside. And he'd be like, oh, okay. And then, I'm getting attention from a lesbian, how exciting. And then they would go outside and she would just shut the door and leave him outside. So this was, which is a great trick, by the way, if you're ever trying to, if we want to do something like that.
Sorry, Hannah, I just wanted to point this out and to make this really clear that within these Reddit forums that you're talking about, you know, the lesbian forums not being allowed to be exclusively female, on the other hand, you have pornography subreddits that are exclusively female, and they say so in their guidelines, and they call this, you know, cis women only, and that's acceptable, but actual communities for lesbian women that exclude men are not acceptable. And you had a great point as well, where you say, it goes without saying that this in turn has had an impact on women's self-perception across the board. Where women exist only as products in male fantasy, the desire to escape such a burden becomes overwhelming. Like the female user who expressed discomfort with the term lesbian because of its association with pornography, many women are being corralled into adopting abstract identities or abandoning association with their sex or sexuality altogether. And I just think that that's really important because we do see that a lot anecdotally on social media as well. And I'm not sure the extent that it's been totally researched, but I've seen also on Reddit women saying basically, you know, I didn't want to be objectified, or I didn't want to be pornified. So I decided to identify as non-binary or whatever identity otherwise that they might choose. So.
Yeah, I think that us in the gender critical movement have to start talking more about pornography in general. I really do, because I think, and we talk about pornography in relation to autogynephilic men, and we talk about sissy hypnoporn, or at least some of us do. And all that's very important and is an aspect of like the global sex industry that I think requires a thorough analysis, definitely. But we also need to think about what it means culturally and socially when the term lesbian just becomes a porn category. when it becomes all about male fantasy. And when we have pornography penetrating, interesting choice of words, but it's the choice of words I'll use, every aspect of society. So it's not anymore, you know, in the times that Catherine MacKinnon and Andrea Dworkin were writing about pornography in the 70s and 80s, where you would have to go to a bookstore, you'd have to go to a magazine shop, you'd have to go to like a pornography theater. Now we have it in our pockets. Now it's, you can watch it in the workplace, you can watch it on public transit, you can watch it in the family home, you can watch it in every aspect of society has become completely penetrated by pornography. And when we know that the average age of being introduced to pornography is about 10 or 11, and girls are also being exposed to pornography in very early childhood or early adolescence, what the cultural and social messages about pornography are, what pornography is saying about lesbians, and then how that shapes a person's self-perception, women's self-perception. And one of the posts that I found really interesting was a woman saying, you know, I don't like the term lesbian in German. It sounds disparaging or derogatory. Is there another word that we could use? And instead of the users being like, oh, well, you know, it's this is part of like an experience of internalized lesbophobia. Many lesbians struggle with this. It's a very common experience. What it was, you know, maybe call yourself queer, maybe call yourself sapphic. So we see this dilution of the reality of female homosexuality, both materially, in that, you know, it's no longer about the material reality of female homosexuality to biological females that exist in the material world, with the political implications for that, but also in terms of language and how that affects self-perception. So I think that, you know, we see there's been some conceptions of lesbianism that it's this oasis away from male sexuality, that it exists on some island away, and then it's a, you know, lesbians are able to express their sexuality away from the male gaze, but we see because of pornography that it's even penetrated lesbian lives. So I think it's a huge driver of transition of young women, really, that we no longer have accurate terms to describe the lesbian experience. And there's a dissociation from the body that I think has been promoted both through the rhetoric of transgenderism, like your body is not important, sex is not real, what matters is these feelings or these ideas. So there's already this massive separation between sexuality and the body, but we're seeing it in terms of, yeah, like pretending as if female sexuality is not real. And and pornography itself, the experience of women watching it, you see a body being degraded, violated, all this violence being perpetrated against these bodies. And and it's the big lie that Dworkin talks about, which is that not only are women, is it justified that women face violence, this is a message in pornography, but the other message is that women like it. That this is the big lie, that women enjoy this kind of degradation. So for young women who are growing up with this content, it's like, I don't enjoy this. And this is what womanhood is. Womanhood is about being a receptacle for violence and aggression. And that's not how I see myself. I want to be a full human. So I think this is a huge driving factor for why so many girls are turning to non-binary identities, turning to transgenderism, because both the language and rhetoric and politics of transgenderism promote this separation between the body and the sexuality, but also it's promoted in pornography.
Yeah, you won't get any argument from me on that. I agree entirely. And I do think it seems fairly obvious to me that what gender ideology does in men's perspective is to define women exactly according to pornography. that we should like being abused, that we're inherently masochistic. These are all the ideas of pornography. It is a movement that is based in the philosophy of pornography. And that's why you have, you know, men with these BDSM masochistic fetishes, you know, claiming a female identity. And so it's like women who see this, especially young women seeing this happen and saying, well, if that's what a woman is, then I can't be a woman because I'm a person. I'm not this object that you're saying. I'm not some kind of performance or thing that you can try on. And of course, pornography reduces women to a performance. The incredible amount of overlaps with this whole phenomenon and pornography are kind of astounding when you start to pick them apart. Speaking of, I'm going to move on to, I think this is what, if Jen were here, she would usually call non-swatch, right? However, this one's not exactly a nonce, just another one of your regular run-of-the-mill BDSM fetishists. But anyway, so there was some good news this month that in the UK, the Equalities and Human Rights Commission, or EHRC, issued a new guidance. And they were basically reasserting what the law already is, that it is lawful to exclude men from women-only spaces, providing that the reasoning is legitimate and proportionate according to the guidance. But because of current misrepresentations by trans activists and lobbying organizations such as Stonewall, it was necessary for the EHRC to issue this reassertion of what the actual particulars are. Now, after that happened, this trans-identified man named Tara Hewitt, who serves as the Equality, Diversity, and Inclusion Lead at the Northern Care Alliance NHS Group, he tweeted out calling the guidance transphobic and urged colleagues within the NHS to ignore it, basically to ignore the law. And several lead NHS staff responded saying that they would adhere to what Hewitt said. And the reason why this is also interesting in particular is that Hewitt himself has publicly stated his interest in BDSM and in dressing up as an animal for sex, something which is called furrydom or being a furry. And also during a 2016 presentation, which was meant to be about cancer, Hewitt talked about men who cross-dress for sexual pleasure. There's a video of this on YouTube that you can see where the only audience members that are visible in the video are women. Fairly certain it wasn't only women, but there were women in the front row as he's talking about this. And he's talking about men wearing women's underwear to satisfy a fetish and explaining that they're included under the trans umbrella. And he said, you've got people that fetishistically cross-dress and wear clothing to get a sexual desire out of the clothing of the opposite gender. It generally tends to be associated with men wearing women's underwear. At that point, he made some kind of condescending joke about women not getting aroused by wearing boxers. But anyway.
Yeah, I mean, my comrade and friend Stuart Parker had made the interesting point about schools in terms of gender ideology and public services, which he said as public schooling is taken over by these ideologues, these people who practice this kind of reified identity politics that is very scary for a lot of parents. More parents are going to turn to private education and charter education. And he believes that this is actually the purpose of it, is to get people to turn away from public services. And I think this is important to put in context with what the NHS has been through and what the NHS is like here in England. It's a public service that started as a bit of an experiment after World War II. And it was so popular that they continued it. And it's been underfunded. Nurses in the UK are paid significantly less than any other comparable country, despite professionalize nursing, really, really beginning here with Florence Nightingale, a woman and a lesbian who thought we should professionalize nursing, have standard practices, and make sure that people are getting the best care that they can. It's no longer about just being a very nice nun or a very virtuous woman. This is a science that we should professionalize. So it's incredible, given this political context where the NHS is already struggling so much. Like, people are leaving to work in private healthcare. And private healthcare is an option here in the UK. It's not like countries like Canada where we don't have a private system in general. And I think this is just going to drive privatization more. I think people are going to think, oh my God, I don't want my elderly mum to be sleeping beside a fetishist, like a man. She doesn't want that. Let's get our money together and let's get her into a private hospital.
By the way, last time we did talk about the revelation that women had been raped in NHS women-only wards by men claiming a transgender identity. So here you have this man who's open about his fetishes publicly, saying that women don't need to have single-sex spaces.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, and this is like, I know this is a point that a lot of gender critical feminists make, but I just don't the kind of men that want to be beside a dying woman in a hospital, who want to be making women like uncomfortable in that situation where a lot of people are bed bound as they're in hospital. Like, you're doing bodily functions in bed. You need to be cared for in these really intimate ways several times a day. Having a man right beside you in that, when you're in that position and you're scared and you don't know what's going on with your health, it would be absolutely mortifying, with or without the threat of rape, which of course is always very real. And I think that there's a very insidious, sinister way that transgenderism and these queer theory activists go after public services that are supposed to care for every person, supposed to care for poor and working people, and put women in these positions. And I do think that it's going to be drive like people trying to get their family members into private healthcare. And it's a very scary thing. And it's also worth noting that I think healthcare is obviously very female dominated. It's one of the few fields that is, even in the management levels, that there's a lots of women in high level management positions within the NHS. And what I see from transgender activists is this clamping down on women. Like, my joke is always is that the average man is more quote unquote gender critical than most gender critical women. Like, if you were to pull a man off the street and go, do you think that, you know, like, men should be in women's sports and change rooms? And do you think it's actually possible to change sex? They go, no, of course not. That's nuts. But there's this huge pressure on young women to indoctrinate them into this ideology. And it's all about policing women. And I think that because the NHS and because healthcare is so women dominated, this is another reason that they've had so much focus on it. It's like, we need these women, even in this space, this professional space that is usually so women dominated, to be obedient. And it's this capitalization on women, particularly women in healthcare, who are, you know, generally socialized to be more compassionate, more giving, more self-sacrificing, putting their needs second, you know, this over-evaluation of being nice and kind above having boundaries and self-respect and saying no. And we see men again and again and again, capitalize on this impulse. Why, you know, when you get into conversations with people about this topic and they say, you know, I agree with you on X and Y and Z, but I just don't think you're being very nice, is often what it comes down to. And I think that another reason they target healthcare is because they know so many of the women will feel pressured to be obedient, really.
Yeah, well, there's likely a lot of things going on. In my darker, more cynical moments, I almost feel like it's the attack on the public services, attack on women's spaces and boundaries altogether is kind of a way of preventing us from going any further. So actually, as they're stripping back our rights, it's keeping us from doing all of the important work that needs to be done on things like pornography. So as men's sexual entitlement is expanding, and even as during the pandemic, as we've seen, violence against women around the world has increased. So we're actually getting into a place of greater and greater danger for women and girls. We now have to be on the defensive constantly for the rights that we already won. I mean, that's, you know, it's hard to say whether that is deliberate. Sometimes I certainly feel like it is, but that's the effect regardless. So speaking of that, I do want to go on to the next point, which is about women's prisons. So again, women's spaces, again, marginalized women. So women in hospitals are in a state of vulnerability, as are women in prisons. So I recently was searching through the New Jersey state offender records. And I was doing this because it had come to light that two women in New Jersey's Edna Mann's Women's Correctional Facility had become pregnant as a result of a transgender identifying male transfer. The policy allowing men to transfer into the women's facility was put into place last year after some kind of a lawsuit with the ACLU. So the state reached a settlement with the ACLU. Anyway, as I was looking through the list of offenders, searching for the male transfers, I came across this story about, okay, so this one's a little bit difficult. So I should let you know that for the listeners that this story involves an extreme amount of violence. So a sadistic male convict who admitted to killing a prostituted woman to satisfy a blood fetish now identifies as transgender and has been transferred to Edna Mann. Perry Cerf was arrested for the brutal rape and murder of 47-year-old Ecuadorian immigrant Flor Andrade in 2002. And Cerf now goes by the name Michelle Heloki Angelina. At the time of his arrest, he was found wearing her clothing and utilizing her identification. Okay, so he was in her car when he was pulled over. He had taped his own photograph over hers on her ID, and he was wearing her clothing. Also, the name Heloki. So Hel is the Norse goddess of death, and Loki is a Norse god that is a deceptive trickster god known for his ability to change sex. All right, so right in his name, he's telling you what he is. So he had written a letter to a major media outlet, the New York Daily News, describing how he killed her, describing how he drank her blood after killing her. He said, "I am Lucifer's maiden servant sent to earth, born of sin to bring suffering and pain, darkness and evil." He said that he drank her blood so I could allow this person to live vicariously through myself. And Cerf has a long history of violence against women. He had tried to kill his adoptive mother as a teenager. He had been in and out of residential treatment programs. He, while incarcerated in the men's prison, was placed in solitary confinement for his aberrant behavior against others while in the men's prison. Okay, so then he also attempted to kill his prison psychiatrist, who was a woman. And this is the man that was transferred into a woman's prison. And this has not been reported by any media outlet apart from Redux, because I discovered this on my own and it has not yet been picked up by any major media.
I mean, what to say? I mean, it's just nuts. I, you know, there's lots of people who are involved in this debate and this issue. And sometimes I listen to some things that the Christians say about it being satanic or whatever. And I'm, you know, you think, oh, okay, maybe, but then you read things like this and you're like, oh my God, it's satanic. No, it's nuts. And I think that for the average uninitiated person, there is this caricature of the sympathetic, just very feminine, probably homosexual man who's just really soft and really nice and is, you know, targeted by other men, vulnerable to other men. And it would just be so nice if he could just be around the women. It would just make his life easier. He's not a threat to anyone. This like mythological, sympathetic character. And then you just read the reality and it's absolutely insane. It's absolutely insane. And I think this is being hidden from the public because in the service of like maintaining this really, this illusion of this very sympathetic male trans inmate who's just like so vulnerable and so feminine and so nice. And I can't imagine what they were thinking. I can't imagine what they were thinking that this would be a good idea. And I think what's happening in prisons and the lack of like, there's not a more marginalized position a woman could probably be in, you know, like women who, like most women in prisons I've read have head injuries from being battered by men. Like it's women who are really, really vulnerable and marginalized, and to put these violent men with them is nuts. And it's also, it's really interesting kind of the nature of his crime, how he taped a picture of himself over her ID. It really is about completely colonizing women, taking our identity, taking our lives. And the identity, the stealing of the identity is an extension of the violence he committed. Like I erased you in life through murder, and now I'm going to erase you in death through taking on your identity. It's very, very frightening. And I'm not surprised it's not being taken up by other news outlets, because I think even right-wing news, I think that some of them just think this stuff is so crazy and unbelievable, I almost don't believe it. And it's those of us who are steeped in it day in, day out, who know the truth of it. It's really, really scary. And what legal options do these women have now in this prison?
Yeah, I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine. I mean, it would now then be on them to take the step to organize, to file a lawsuit, perhaps against the state. I mean, the betrayal of the ACLU in all of this really just deserves its own kind of episode because it's so massive. But I did want to mention as well something I found interesting because I had started looking into this prison, Edna Mann's Women's Prison, last year. Now, I was looking into it prior to the ACLU settlement because I had been reading about, you know, abuses of women across the U.S. in women's prisons. And this one stood out in particular for its long and shocking history of violence against women that has been documented since at least 1990. So we have over 30 years and over 70 reports, multiple lawsuits filed by women, including for things like rape. And the Department of Justice had found, quote, that Edna Mann fails to keep prisoners safe from sexual abuse by staff. So this DOJ report was released in 2020, saying that despite years of notice and efforts towards change at the state level, abuse continued to persist. So they charged the prison with a culture of acceptance of sexual abuse in 2020. Nothing was done. Nothing changed. Okay. Then in 2021, guess what happens? A group of women were pulled out of their cells during a cell extraction to search for contraband. One of the inmates was a trans-identified male named Raekwon Rollins. He was beaten along with the women. The women were also sexually assaulted. He filed a lawsuit in March of that year, last year. Immediately action was taken. Within that same month, 31 guards were suspended. the prison's top administrator was suspended. A formal investigation was opened by the state. You can't make this up. Him and along with all of these other unnamed women that were beaten, one woman said she was punched 28 times in the head. They were mentioned in major outlets like the New York Times as something extra tacked on to this man's story. So the headlines that were running were transgender woman attacked in prison. And so he was attacked in the women's prison. He found the women's prison to be too severe for him. So he transferred back to a men's prison. After he was transferred to another men's prison, he complained again, was put in another state, a women's prison in another state. Okay. So I'm actually sorry. I'm really pissed off about this. If you can't tell, the women were not allowed to transfer out. The man who had asked to be put in there was allowed to transfer out. You see, so it's just stunning. It's the extent to which society will empathize with male suffering to the complete absence of care for women's suffering whatsoever. I feel like this whole situation just really brings that into focus.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Catholic Church sexual abuse scandals in some ways, in that when we think those scandals or that continuing ongoing scandal, the victim of the priest that comes to mind is a little boy, right? Like the jokes, the discourse is always about priests noncing little boys. And of course, like little boys were victims of child sexual abuse and are victims of child sexual abuse, and the status of children and women are very connected. And I don't want to minimize that in any way, but really the majority of the victims were girls, and often teenage girls as well. So it's interesting how, I know this man wasn't sexually assaulted, as far as I know, by the staff, but it's interesting how there isn't really a call to action in society about these huge systemic problems until it's men who are also being abused. And it makes me thoughtful about the situation with prisons, women's prisons in Canada, which is that there were a few high profile suicides in women's prisons in Canada. And as a result of that, and also lawsuits about abuse and the rest of it, they put together a women's first prison scheme, basically, to try and provide women with more appropriate care. So they introduced more like mother and baby programs, more psychological support for women in the prisons, more counseling. One of the women's prisons in Canada, in Saskatchewan, I believe, is a healing lodge. So most women in prison are Indigenous in Canada. So it's supposed to be like a culturally competent facility where women can get in touch with their culture. It's supposed to be less restrictive, this sort of thing. It's supposed to be this very humane program, basically. And what we're seeing is men being transferred into these prisons with these quote unquote women first programs. And for example, for women who are convicted of sexual crimes, they're all convicted because they facilitated the sexual crimes of a man. So they were partners with a man who was abusing children, and they provided access for that man to the children, whatever. So the Heather Mason, the Canadian women's prisons activist, was saying that the programs that they give those women are about setting boundaries, how to say no to men, you know, valuing yourself and your children before men in your lives, whatever. And then they're putting men who are convicted of sexual crimes for like rape into these sorts of programs. So it's just nuts. And it goes to show also that just like there should not be male guards in women's prisons. There's no reason for it.
I was reading a little bit about the history of this. This is something I wanted to look more deeply into as well. So I don't have all of the information, but one thing I did notice was that there was some kind of report about how this really kind of got started, where men were being allowed to be prison guards. And of course, it had to do with sex discrimination. So they would say that it's discrimination on for men, right? Mm-hmm. But there, in the U.S., there's a long history of, you know, women trying to get sex segregated prisons. And there is some research to suggest that perhaps part of the reason that men were allowed to be prison guards was because there was basically it was fostering what they would have called a lesbian culture. So women having sex with each other. So I wanted to look into that further to see if I can see if is this possibly a driving motivator for having allowed men into the women's prison? Because as we see, anytime that women have a separate space away from men, it poses a threat to the male order. It allows women to establish relationships together or to otherwise organize and get along with each other, which is not conducive to the current system that we have now. But I did want to also point out the rates of women who have been sexually abused who end up in prison as well, because sexual abuse can cause PTSD. It can cause, you know, drug offenses. They're kind of interlinked with mental health conditions. So some women's rights activists have described a phenomenon called the sexual abuse to prison pipeline. So now you have a group of women who have perhaps, you know, have been victims of male violence themselves in some capacity, being expected to be housed with violent men. It's like torture.
Yeah, it is like, and it reminds me of Trisha Bapti, the Indigenous anti-prostitution activist from Vancouver. And she talks about the foster care to prostitution to prison pipeline. And I think it's girls who are taken into foster care, often sexually abused, neglected, abandoned in foster care, taken in by quote unquote boyfriends who are really pimps, who say, I'll give you a nice place to stay if you have sex with my friends. And then getting involved with drugs in order to numb the pain of being raped day in and day out, and then getting involved in petty crime and then prison and the rest of it. It is a pipeline. And you're right about single sex spaces being a threat to the male order. And that's what I find often frustrating about conversations we have about single sex spaces, even within the gender critical movement. And I understand why people have to frame things this way, because we're not talking to radical feminists, we're talking to the general public. You know, we talk about single sex spaces being important in very specific, very tiny circumstances. But the reason single sex spaces are so vilified and hated by these men is for the reasons that you point out, because there's opportunity for political organizing, solidarity, lesbian relationships, these sorts of things that are very threatening to men, which is why, you know, patriarchy, particularly under capitalism, has put women in these itemized little homes separate from each other within the nuclear family and always attached to a man. So I think when we have our analysis of single sex spaces, we always have to keep that kind of front of mind as well. It's not just that we want them in these very specific circumstances, only when we've been incredibly raped and battered and abused or whatever. We should be entitled to them at all times for really any reasons, for purposes of sisterhood, political organizing, solidarity with each other.
Right. So switching gears a little bit, let's talk briefly about the British cycling news that happened earlier this month. So we had a case where a trans-identified cyclist who goes by the name Emily Bridges wanted to compete in the National Omnium Championships. So Bridges is currently 21 years old. He's very young. He had set a national junior men's record for a 25-mile time in 2018. I believe he would have been something like 18 or 19 at that time when he set the record. But anyway, he had set a men's record prior to identifying as a woman. So after some pushback from women's rights activists, 2 days before the race was set to occur, the world governing body for sports insisted on further scrutiny, and they then revoked his eligibility to compete in the race He would have been racing against a five-time Olympic champion, Dame Laura Kenny. So there was a lot of pushback against this, which resulted in him being eventually not really disbarred, but they wanted to have a chance to look at the guidelines again. And some prominent women athletes spoke out against this. Sharon Davies, who has been speaking out for women's sports for a couple of years now, she's an Olympic swimmer from the UK. She spoke out against Bridges' inclusion in the race. She said that she was contacted by a number of women cyclists who were afraid about speaking out. She also told GB News, we can have inclusion and fairness, we just have to put fairness first. If you look across Olympic sports, and that includes cycling, you are looking at 10 to 20, even 30% in weightlifting difference, which is absolutely vast. And anyone who's gone through male puberty will not be able to mitigate against all of those advantages. And she added, British cycling ought to be ashamed of themselves. I have had quite a few of the girls very distressed on the phone. They're frustrated and disappointed. I can't see how this isn't sexual discrimination in the tallest order.
Yeah, I had an ex-girlfriend, or have an ex-girlfriend, who is a cyclist and quite a serious one. And she kind of explained to me that it's a bit of the new golf. The thing with weightlifting in the Olympics, that it's a sport that's not particularly not cycling, and there are many women involved in it who are very gender nonconforming. So people are like, they're kind of mannish lesbians anyway, who cares if there's a man also there? But something like cycling, swimming, like it's just not going to happen. It's a massive misstep for them to think that they can get away with this. It's like people with money actually care about these sports. So they're not really going to let you just come in and ruin them. And it's incredible that like this boy thinks that he, because what's nuts about this is even in the Laurel Hubbard case, he was a man who was a pretty shit weightlifter, even in the male category.
He was also twice as old as the women competing.
That's right. Yeah. But now we have a young man who has like set male records. Like, this is nuts. This is totally nuts. This is not like even an average man. This is not even Leah Thomas, who I understand is a pretty shit male swimmer. This is like a very good cyclist. Like, why would you be able to compete with the women? I honestly think so much of this also is like son worship, is like people telling their sons that they can do whatever they want their whole lives with no consequences. I think this is another big reason why we don't see women calling themselves men trying to get into male sports quite as much, is because they have had more limits and boundaries as they've grown up, whereas boys are basically worshipped and told they can do anything.
When I told you you could be anything you wanted when you grew up, I didn't mean a woman.
Yeah, literally. That's insane. Well, I'm very happy that they stopped it and that they're giving it a bit of a pause. I think they might have thought, oh, he's a man, but maybe he's quite shit, so we don't have to worry too much about it. But when they saw that he had set some records, they're thinking this will just make a joke of the whole race. But I know with Leah Thomas, I should just start calling him Will Thomas. I know with Will Thomas, he, like in the second, the first race he did, he beat the women by like 40 seconds, like some ridiculous, stupid margin. And then when he did it again, like Linda Spent-Blade, who is that sports scientist who's gender critical and does some very good work on this issue, was saying that he wasn't moving his legs when he was swimming. He was just moving his arms, and he still managed to beat the women. So I don't know if that was his plan, was just to cycle real slow. But I also know with cycling, from my experience of being with a cyclist, it has a lot to do with the length of your legs and also your weight, because the heavier you are, the faster you go down a hill, basically, because you have your body weight pushing you down against with gravity. So like, I think he would have just destroyed he would have won by like an hour margin or something. And like, it would have been stupid.
And men have a different center of gravity as well. They carry it in their shoulders versus women carry it in their hips. So that might make a difference too. But I mean, I think, you know, again, I'm always very cynical, sorry, but I almost feel like British cycling took this action because the backlash, if he had won against a five-time Olympian woman, Dame Laura Kenny, if he had won against her, could you imagine? I mean,
yeah,
that would just, I feel like that would go international. People would have been very, very upset about that. So again, I almost feel like it's like they are protecting not the women, they're protecting the men in a way.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting that they require other men to protect them from themselves because of their own delusions. It's like, this is going to be, you're right, because that would demonstrate it as a full joke. Like if he had beat a five-time Olympic medalist with the margin that I imagine that he would beat them with, it would just expose it as a joke for everyone everywhere. And men don't care about women in prisons. Men don't care about rape. Men care about sports. So I think you're right. I think this is, yeah, like a 21-year-old who doesn't understand that you can't actually have everything that you want, even within the bounds of like what would be politically advantageous for your cause.
So the other day, the Florida Department of Health issued a press release discouraging all forms of medical and social treatment for gender dysphoria in children and adolescents. Under the new guidance, children under 18 should not be prescribed hormone therapy or puberty blockers, and gender reassignment surgery should not be a treatment option for children or adolescents. And the department goes on to reference a 2021 study from the Journal of Infant, Child, and Adolescent Psychotherapy saying, encouraging mastectomy, ovarectomy, uterine extirpation, penile disablement, tracheal shave, the prescription of hormones which are out of line with the genetic makeup of the child, or puberty blockers, are all clinical practices which run unacceptably high risk of doing harm. So we're finally starting to get some of the pushback in writing now. So this is actually going against what the federal government of the U.S. Might say. Now, I don't believe we have that explicitly detailed yet, although I expect with the current Assistant Secretary of Health, Dr. Rachel Richard Levine, that we will probably have something written coming from the federal government on this issue. But for now, it's great news. And if anything, it hopefully gives some courage to other states to take a stand against this. Well, to be frank, the medical abuse and experimentation on children.
No, I think it's great. I've obviously, well done to the Florida Department of Health for coming out with this memorandum. I think it's amazing. I mean, I think that doctors are often concerned about liability and concerned about being sued for malpractice and want to protect themselves. And I've always thought that it was very odd that they were going forward with this kind of regime, the WPATH guidelines and the puberty blockers and everything else, because I've always thought, out of your own self-interest, aren't you concerned about being sued? Aren't you concerned about being involved in a medical scandal? I've also felt that way about psychologists and social workers and I suppose psychiatrists who would be, medical doctors as well. But I've also thought that with reference to the gender conversion stuff or the conversion therapy stuff of, you know, if you tell a kid, hey, maybe these feelings of not being comfortable in your body has to do with your childhood sexual abuse. Maybe you're not trans. Maybe we should take a step back. And then I think the Canadian law says that you can be put in prison for 5 years for saying that. And I've always wondered, why aren't professionals more concerned just out of self-interest? I remember when Canada now has what they call medical assistance in dying, which is really, it's a euphemism for assisted suicide, which I'm completely and totally against. But they have it in Canada. And when that discussion was happening, when that laws were being passed, there was doctors going, oh my God, I'm so concerned about my being sued here or being criminally prosecuted for murder. You're going to have to make this incredibly clear about when we can and cannot do this. And there were doctors involved, and there was all this like facilitative discussion going on about, oh my God, we're so concerned with our liability. I've always wondered why there wasn't more concern about liability within the medical profession. And I think this is probably the first wave of that, of saying, you know, we as doctors are against this. We don't really want to be sued. And my only theory about why it has gone on for this long is A, it's ideological. And obviously some of these doctors are genuinely convinced, but I think most doctors don't know this is happening. Like most family physicians who, you know, see people at their practice or their surgery, or most surgeons or emergency room doctors or just average physicians day in, day out, don't know the extent of this and don't know how much it really implicates them legally. So I think we're going to start seeing more of a backlash from the legal profession going, hey, we don't actually want anything to do with this, as lawsuits become more and more imminent.
Well, I think it's certainly a lot of factors involved, like you said, but I think one other factor that you didn't mention is the corruption in the U.S. medical system is off the charts. And mm-hmm. what tends to happen, and I'll use like Lupron for an example. Okay. So Lupron is the drug that is currently being euphemistically referred to as a puberty blocker. In the U.S., it's the leading prescribed drug for use as a puberty blocker. Okay. But so Lupron itself had been involved. Well, its makers were involved in a huge lawsuit about 20 years ago. At the time, they had settled for a record $875 million for fraud. So what tends to happen with medical corruption in the U.S. is just money changes hands. So there will be a huge payout to the government. Doctors aren't really so much affected in and of themselves, like this particular case with Lupron. So Takeda Abbott is the name of the manufacturer. They were actually bribing doctors to prescribe it. Now, they were also giving them kickbacks, and in particular, if they could find a reason to prescribe it. So it isn't still approved for the current use of puberty blockers, which is not to say that off-label uses are always bad. However, when you have the company making the drug looking for explicit reasons to prescribe it off-label, perhaps because they know how toxic it is, for example, because they had done some research on using it as chemical castration in sex offenders. So it is a drug that has a known history to have a castrating effect. And what's interesting about this too is that it is only given to the worst and most recidivist sex offenders because of its side effects. So it's not even given to just, they do it very selectively. So there has been some known issues with this drug, quite a lot of them actually. I could just talk about it for a very long time about how the harms it's done to women, again, the harms being done to women that no one really seems to pay attention to, that have been going on for quite some time. In particular, they were given this drug for precocious puberty, quote unquote, and for endometriosis, basically a lot of under-researched women's health conditions that they were given this drug for, and then describe things like their jawbones deteriorating in their face and their teeth falling out. Horrific, horrific stuff, you know? So this can't come soon enough, as far as I'm concerned, with the blocking of the use of puberty blockers, which we did see, what was it, in about October or November last year, the Karolinska Hospital in Sweden, a doctor came forward and actually used the words chemical castration here, because that's what's going on. Hannah, I learned recently that a polite term, a more polite term for chemical castration is called hormone therapy.
Oh, of course. I mean, it's just the euphemisms that hormone therapy was meant to be prescribed to women going through menopause. That's where the term hormone therapy comes from, to alleviate some of the symptoms of menopause. Now there's been a huge rolling back actually of using hormone therapy for women going to through menopause, because it's been linked to breast cancers to a huge degree. So there's been, those drugs should be prescribed with, you know, restraint. It's like, I think that's genuinely how they're prescribed now, because even giving this exogenous estrogen to women going through menopause can be quite dangerous. This is very like dangerous stuff. And this is why, like, as feminists, we can't be in favor of for-profit healthcare. There's just no justification for it. And it's not that I think that we want men in the state to control our bodies or our healthcare, but we can't, there's no way to provide healthcare for women in an institution that has been historically used as a mode of oppression for women so much, medical science. There's to actually introduce a profit motive into healthcare is completely completely terrible for women's rights. There's no way as a feminist, I think anyone could support for-profit healthcare. And I think it goes back to our conversation about the NHS kind of earlier in the show. What we really need is women controlled healthcare. Women are already the majority in healthcare, and it really should be, we're now graduating more women doctors than we are male doctors, and we should continue with that, because we know that this institution has been so historically used to oppress women, and it's actually a bit of bargaining power we can have in society. We control the healthcare, so you should listen to us. So I think having public women-controlled, women-centered healthcare is a really important demand for feminists. And when you introduce a profit motive, and that's why, you know, the situation with transitioning children, quote unquote, I'm really trying to stop using the term transitioning because it's another euphemism, but giving mastectomies and exogenous hormones and chopping off bodily organs of children is happening in the United States because it's a free for all because of what, you know, the amount of profit that can be made from it. Like that Dr. Gallagher is living a very like happy life in Miami. She probably makes a few thousand dollars a day doing this stuff. She lives in a beautiful beachfront house that she displays on her TikTok on the regular. Healthcare should be done, should be controlled by women, for women, and in the public interest, without any profit motive, because this is what happens. And I think that, yeah, the Florida Department of Health coming out with this, it's a guidance, right? Is it legally binding in any way, or?
Well, it's the State Department. All right. Right. So as I understand it, you know, here's the tricky thing about the US, right? So you can have the federal law, and then also you have state laws. So what would have to happen, I think, is that the federal government would have to intervene in some capacity, and then perhaps even set federal guidelines. Then, if the state wanted to, they could challenge that and then take that to the Supreme Court. So it would be a really long, ongoing affair. But until the federal government puts out explicit guidelines about the medical intervention with children's puberty and so on, I think they're well within their right to enforce this policy on the state level. But let's do talk about Dr. Gallagher for a second, because sure. there is a woman in Orlando, Florida, by the name of Kendra Paris, and she is seeking information from any past patients of Dr. Gallagher who would wish to file a formal complaint or perhaps a class action lawsuit against her. Now, the interesting thing about Dr. Gallagher, which I didn't know until hearing from Kendra, she started by performing what are euphemistically called bottom surgeries on men, actually. And some complaints have been found from her previous patients in this regard online. One of the patients in a review posted on December 2017, he called her vaginoplasty. So vaginoplasty has to do with the quote unquote bottom surgery for men.
It's a penile inversion,
technically. So he referred to the surgery itself as, quote, a clusterfuck of sorrow. And he had started taking illegal drugs in order to cope with the pain the botched surgery had left him with. But after this time period where she was performing these surgeries on males, she changed states. So she moved out of that state and then moved to Florida and began targeting young women and girls for double mastectomies, a large portion of which she's getting through her TikTok videos, where there's some indication that she has performed these surgeries on teenagers, so minors, perhaps even children as young as around 13 or 15. There was a picture that was floating around of a young girl with Dr. Gallagher who had self-harm scars and cuts all over her chest and arms. And she was posing with the post-op surgery stitches. It was really disturbing. So with that being said, I just really hope we can get some of these previous patients of Dr. Gallagher to come forward.
Yeah, and I just want to say, when you've been through, I mean, I'm not a detransitioner. I don't have like a lived experience with this, but I think when you've been through something like that, that is so traumatic, and then you've also had to publicly go like, oh, I regret this. It's so difficult, right? Especially on the age of the internet, where there are, you know, receipts of everything, and you felt one way and now you feel another way, and it's embarrassing and it's awful. It's also really hard to come to terms with, like, I've made this irreversible mistake. Like, I can only imagine. But I think one thing women can do when you've been in that situation, in order to like take your power back and feel like go forward with your life, is to do action to help yourself, to like make sure that what happened to you doesn't happen to other women. And I know it's completely easier said than done, and every woman has to consider her own life circumstances or whatever, but I really think that for women who have been victimized this way by this surgeon, I think it would be a really good thing to reach out to this attorney. I think it would really help in the process of coming to terms with what happened. And I encourage women to do so. And I know that there is a community of detransitioners. There are many other women who have shared this experience. You're not alone in this, far from it. And those of us in the gender critical movement, radical feminists, will always be here to support you with what you need. And you know, I think going through with contacting this lawyer will be a big step and a really important step in order to protect other women.
Thanks again for tuning in. To reach out to Kendra Paris, you can find her on Twitter at BusyBaudy, that's Baudy, BAUDY, or you can contact her via email at info@parislaw.org. So Paris with two R's, parislaw.org.